Welcome to Planning Law with Chickens, the occasional podcast series about all things planning law and planning, brought to you by the specialist planning law firm Town Legal. I'm Meeta Kaur, partner at Town. This is the first in a new strand of our podcast, in fact, the case law brief. The idea is that we'll give you a summary of a case that will last no more than about 10 to 15 minutes, but crucially, it's going to be given by a barrister involved in the case. I mean, who better to give you the best view other than somebody with a view of the inside? To kick off our case law brief series, we're going to start with the case that has probably had and continues to have more impact and practical consequences, not necessarily good ones, than any other case has in the last few years. That case is, of course, Hillside Parks and Snowdonia National Park Authority. And who better tell us all about the recent Supreme Court judgment than Charlie Banner KC, who acted for Hillside Parks in that case. So all I need to do now is just hand over to Charlie.
Hello, this is Charlie Banner, KC of Keating Chambers, and I'm here to discuss the Hillside Park Supreme Court judgment. So for me, the journey on Hillside started at the Supreme Court stage. I wasn't involved in the High Court and Court of Appeal, but I covered the Court of Appeal's judgment as a case report on my podcast, Have We Got Planning News For You?, which I appear alongside Town Legal's very own Mary Cook. And on preparing the case report, I did feel that there were a number of inadequacies with the Court of Appeal's judgment, most striking of which was the leaving open of the question whether a development is unlawful and vulnerable to enforcement action at any stage until it's completed pursuant to the original planning permission. And that rendered open the prospect of, say, for example, Mrs. Jones living on phase one of a five-phase residential development, being potentially subject to enforcement action many years after buying her house if the developer went bust and the development wasn't complete. And that seemed to me and a number of people to be questionable, to say the least. And there are other aspects of the Court of Appeal's judgment with which many in the industry felt were lacking in clarity. So what happened then is I contacted the barrister acting for Hillside Parks, Robin Green, an excellent barrister at Cornerstone Chambers, and asked him if the developer was planning to appeal. And he said he didn't think the developer was because it had lost emphatically in the High Court and Court of Appeal. One thing led to another, and Robin and I had a conversation with the owner of Hillside Parks Limited, Chris Maiden, more on him in a moment. And we did decide, he did decide to seek permission to appeal. Everything happened very quickly because we, by this stage, we were, I think, on about day 25 of the 28-day time limit for seeking permission to appeal from the Court of Appeal, which you have to seek before asking the Supreme Court for permission to appeal. Almost always the Court of Appeal refuses permission to appeal to the Supreme Court, but it's a hoop you have to jump through. So we were all hands on deck, working long hours till late in the night, and the appeal, well, it was permission to appeal application was submitted to the Court of Appeal. They, as a matter of course, refused it. As I said, that's routine. We then went to the Supreme Court and asked them for permission to appeal, and they said, yes, granted permission to appeal, and then The appeal was live. And during all of this, as well as Robin and me being involved, and David Harris from Aaron and Partners, Simon Ricketts came on board from Town Legal as well, which was a great boost following his widely read blog post about Hillside. And also my colleague from Keating Chambers, Matt Finn. So we had this all-star team, which was great and bounced various ideas off each other. So then the next stage for me, which was a real privilege, was in May last year, where I actually went to Hillside Parks. You might recall, those who are listening, that there was a time last May when the only form of permissible holiday was self-catering during the final stages of the lockdown. And the first phase of Hillside Parks development is in fact self-catering accommodation. So lovely Maybank holiday, went there, had a look around. Then we put together the printed case, which is the Supreme Court term for a skeleton argument. And by this stage, we had a further member of the team in the form of Lord Robert Carnwath, the fairly recently retired Supreme Court judge who was the lead planning judge in the Supreme Court, and he incidentally was also the second junior barrister in the Pilkington case, which was at the heart of this judgment. So Robert was involved in reviewing the documents. He reviewed a draft of our printed case and gave some comments, as well as commenting on potential lies to take at the hearing, which was a huge, not just a luxury, a privilege, hugely helpful for me as the advocate for Hillside. And indeed, during the hearing itself, he was sending me messages during my opponent's submissions, say on lines potentially taken, my reply. So that was a unusual aspect of the case, a practice which is quite prevalent in the United States, actually, former judges coming on as consultants to litigation teams in major appellate litigation, but not something that, to my understanding, is a particularly major feature of appellate litigation in the UK, but something I would advocate. It was extremely useful. The hearing itself appeared to have gone very well for the appellants. The general impression, I'm not just saying this because I was the advocate for the appellant, but the general impression from most of those in the room and watching it was that the reaction from all but one of the judges was very positive to Hillside. Lord Reed in particular, the judge, the one judge there with real practical planning experience, was overtly supportive of the arguments. And then in the judgment itself, although on the facts Hillside lost, there were a number of aspects of the judgment where the Court of Appeal either rejected or modified or clarified the analysis of the Court of Appeal and rejected some of the more extreme arguments of the respondent. So in terms of the actual law, it was by no means a defeat for the development industry or for the legal arguments put forward by Hillside. There are aspects of it which I think make the judgment perhaps or might call a bit of a curate's egg or a mixed bag. And I'm not being rude about the judgment in saying that. There's aspects which do make it more difficult for the development industry, but a lot of aspects of the judgment which provide practical ways forward for those who are or are advising on the development of large projects which need to be modified during their lifetime. So what are the key messages? I'm not going to tell listeners what the judgment actually says, because I'm assuming that most people listening to this will be familiar with the broad terms of the judgment, and the time limitations that this podcast would preclude me from going into the detail. But I'm going to focus on the key implications. And it seems to me that they are as follows. Firstly, and quite probably most importantly, the court made clear that a part completed development pursuant to a planning permission is not unlawful and not subject to enforcement prior to its completion. So that's the first one. So the Mrs. Jones in my example I gave a few moments ago is safe and can sleep well in her house at night knowing that it cannot be enforced against. In relation to the Pilkington principle, which, as listeners will appreciate, concerns where there were two successive permissions for development on land and the later permission, once implemented, means that it's physically impossible to build out the entirety of the earlier permission. That principle does apply to the drop-in type scenario. However, there are two important provisos. Firstly, where the physical impossibility of building out the rest of permission A arising because of the implementation of permission B, where that physical impossibility is not material in the context of the scheme as a whole, the Supreme Court's words, then the Pilkington principle doesn't result in the loss of the ability to rely on permission A going forward. And secondly, it may be that the relevant part of permission A, which is rendered physically impossible, is severable. And if it's severable, then the Pilkington principle will mean that that part can no longer be relied upon, but the remainder of the permission can be relied upon to further develop under permission A. What does non-material mean? Non-material is likely to mean the same as a Section 96A non-material amendment. The Supreme Court didn't say that precisely, but in the very next paragraph, after setting out the non-material exemption from the Pilkington principle, they went on to say that that wasn't inconsistent with Section 96A LMA. So it seems to me they had in mind, at least broadly, but I think almost certainly exactly the same parameters. Severability, the court went on to say, required express words. So the court found that an earlier case of called Lucas, judgment of Mr. Justice Wynne predating the Pilkington case, that earlier case was wrongly decided because in that case, the court had inferred that the permission was for several independent, severable acts of development when there wasn't express wording. So express wording is needed. What kind of wording is needed to make a permission, a several permission? Well, I think seems to me that at least until there is some further guidance on this from court, as surely there will be in due course, you need to get the actual word severable in there somewhere and probably reinforce it, buttress it with some other word like independent, self-contained, or indeed both of those. So say, for example, application for outline planning permission for up to, and those words are important, up to 500 homes and a retail superstore of X square metres, comprised of the following severable, self-contained individual elements. Roman numeral one, up to 100 homes, Roman numeral two, up to another 100 homes on this particular area, and so on and so forth. And words to that effect, it seems to me, would in principle be capable of being effective to mean that if one of those elements could no longer be physically built out because of the effect of a later permission, that would not preclude the rest of the permission being built out. There may be a need for care in terms of EIA, because if a permission is being sought in those terms, it seems to me the environmental statement ought to be looking at the environmental effects, not just of the whole, but what if only one element came forward, or what if a combination of those elements came forward? Ditto in terms of the consideration in the officer's report of the benefits. If the benefits of the whole development are held to outweigh the impacts, potentially that could give rise to a JR risk if the permission is phrased in such a way that the benefits might not come forward until at all, but the harms will come forward at the beginning under the severable concept. So care is needed. But in principle, that's a workaround. Also, a final phase drop-in would be possible. Given the Supreme Court held that a part completed development is not unlawful, it may be possible in some cases to leave the aspect of the development which you want to replace with a drop-in permission until the end. And if you do that, then you can exhaust all you need from permission A, and then you don't need to rely on it anymore. And then simply drop in a new permission B in place of the last bit. If, for example, the hotel is no longer viable because of COVID and you want to replace the hotel with something else, then just leave that to the end. That may require rejigging a phasing condition or a phasing Section 106 obligation. That's fairly straightforward. The Supreme Court had in mind a site-wide variation whereby permission B could be interpreted as authorising a variation to permission A if it covers the whole site. The Supreme Court thought this would need a plan showing how the new permission incorporates the changes into coherent design for the whole site, their words. In that situation, the Supreme Court saw the position as the permission governing the planning framework for the whole site would then be permission B, the variation on its own. It wouldn't be working in conjunction with the first mission. It would just replace the first mission. So there wouldn't be any issue of Pilkington. That's good to know. And it gives a last line of resort for developers needing to make variations where other workarounds aren't possible. But I suspect it will be a last line of resort because a site-wide permission is going to be expensive in terms of application fees and probably more complicated than the court appreciated in terms of EIA and habitats and other assessment. Also, slot out and drop in combinations may still be workable in at least some circumstances. By slot out, I mean where the original permission. Permission A, I've referred to it in earlier observations. Permission A is amended, in inverted commas, usually through a Section 73 permission, which changes the plans authorised so as to create white land, land on which under the original permission nothing is proposed, because, say, for example, development is decanted from that land to the rest of the land, the subject of the first permission. So create the white land, and if a description of development needs to be changed, then that can be done sometimes through a Section 96A non-material amendment. It can't, of course, be done under Section 73 due to Finney. By creating that white land, by decanting the development authorised by the first permission away from a particular area on the site, you can then drop in a site-specific, focused, localised consent for whatever the new or changed thing you want to do in that white land. And that won't engage Pilkington, because the effect of creating that white land in the original permission through typically the Section 73 is that the development authorised for the first permission doesn't need that white land. It's envisaged to be dealt with elsewhere on the development site. So filling in that white land with the drop-in permission doesn't render physically impossible the development authorised by the first permission. Therefore, there isn't scope for any Pilkington argument. So that's potentially going to be a valuable way forward. And certainly if it is achievable in the facts of any case, it's going to be more attractive than the site-wide variation discussed by the Supreme Court. Lastly, a word about conveyancing and land sale contracts. It does seem to me to be important now that a owner of a large development site, or the master developer in carving out parcels to be sold to separate developers, make sure there is some kind of private law control on what the purchaser does on that site by way of any new applications, because there's otherwise a risk that the purchaser of the site may decide not to implement their part of the governing site-wide permission, but seek to apply for fresh planning permission for something materially different on the bit of the site that they've bought. And that, of course, could then be a Hillside Pilkington issue if the difference between the permission that the purchaser acquires for their part of the site is materially different from what was envisaged for that part of the site under the overall permission that had been obtained by the promoter, landowner, master developer. So it seems to me that some kind of constraint in the land transaction, for example, a requirement to obtain consent before applying for planning permission, such consent not to be unreasonably withheld, would be vital to ensure that there's ongoing control to avoid any Hillside stroke Pilkington type issues arising. So that concludes my potted history of the journey of the Hillside case in the Supreme Court and the main implications of the judgment. I hope you found it an interesting listen. Thank you.